Here we go.
Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Hello, everybody. It is June 21st, and this is the Q&A call for the ARC website. So we've got a boatload of questions today, so let's jump on those puppies and see if we can get some of this stuff figured out. Right here, I'm getting back to my questions. I've got two different things happening. Okay, I've lost all the questions. Hang on just a second.
Good thing Rick's always late.
I'm not late. I'm right here.
No, you're late. We're trying to get lunch, so don't read yet.
Okay, no. Okay, I'll try not to. I knew y'all'd be impressed if I was on time.
Yeah, the one day.
So, tell me when I can start. There's someone who went silent here.
Okay.
Okay, go. Go, okay. So, how do you deal with a spouse that says he doesn't have feelings, that he really doesn't feel very much at all? I thought we all had feelings. I don't understand this. Okay, so a lot of times what happens either through abuse or through trauma, people actually go pretty psychologically numb, and there's several reasons that people don't experience much in the way of feelings. For some people, they've actually been much more of a thinker than a feeler, and they've never really taken the time to tune in to experience feelings. Frequently, if I've got a male or a female that really doesn't experience much in the way of feelings, then I actually have them start doing feeling development exercises. I had a physicist come in a couple of years back, and he wanted to learn how to feel. That was his goal in life. So the way we did that was I gave him a feeling sheet, and each day he had to identify three or four feelings he had during the day. What was interesting about the whole process is that finally, one day he lost his feeling sheet, and I remember him calling me saying, "I've lost my feelings," and he was just kind of freaked out because he really didn't even know yet how to do the feelings without visually being able to kind of stop and identify. But over time, he was able to slowly develop that awareness of what he was feeling. Many men, for instance, may not have cried for decades, and that's because it's so kind of shut off. They have what I call a head-heart split that kind of shut off being able to feel anything. So there are certain things you can do, like DEFCON 3 for me when I'm working with somebody with no feelings, is I'll have them start watching movies to relate to feelings in a movie, something like Old Yeller or Where the Red Fern Grows, or Big Fish, something I think that might actually begin to touch an emotion and allow them to experience emotions. One of my best friends, when he went into recovery, really hadn't had much, many feelings for, again, decades. I remember he was so excited when he actually cried for the first time in probably 25 years. And his wife, who was there with him when we were talking, was furious at him because she didn't get to be there when he cried and she felt really robbed. And he was actually out of town at a conference and somebody had said something that just finally touched his heart. And for her, that was difficult because she wanted that first experience to be with her. But I do think that people sometimes have to almost learn how to feel again. But one other thing about those feelings, guys, actually the dividing barrier between the left and the right hemisphere, you experience feelings more or less in the right hemisphere. The analytical portion of the brain is in the left hemisphere. Well, when it comes to feelings, guys have a very narrow bandwidth in terms of processing ability to move information from the right to the left hemisphere and from the left to the right hemisphere. That is actually created, that block or that barrier is actually created by testosterone, women not having testosterone, you ladies are working on like a 16-lane highway. The guy's working on a single-lane bridge. I mean, that's about how fast the traffic flows back and forth compared to what y'all do. So for a man, frequently, just physiologically, it takes a long time for him to process the information from right to left, be able to kind of get his mind, analyze it, and then be able to verbalize it. The verbal section is actually on the left-hand side along with the mathematical part. So practice learning how, you know, if they begin to practice learning how to do that, they can begin to feel, express feelings, express emotions, but it actually, for many people, is something that has to be learned. See, to add to Laura's comment about feelings, I too have struggled with having long periods of numbness. This is why I used men or work to medicate so that I would feel something, rush, anticipation, excitement, infatuation. What is this and how to move to live your life in the balance of health and feelings? Again, learning, feeling development, you almost need to begin to follow a protocol. A simple exercise, and I think I actually gave this to in one of the talks recently, is at night before you go to bed, each share a feeling you had during the day, then share a previous time in your life when you experienced the same feeling, and then go ahead and share something you appreciate with your mate. That will kind of, again, begin to get you to think in terms of feelings, or get one of the feeling sheets you can find online, the faces, or I think if you went to EMS, you got one in your EMS book, and try to identify three feelings you had during the day and talk with your husband about that. And so that, in turn, will, again, help you with that skill development. Besides making love, the next question, what are other ways to increase intimacy between me and my partner? We turned our guest bedroom into a meditation reading room, and we're going to meditate together, not medicate, excuse me, and read together. Will this increase intimacy? What else? Also, I've noticed that when my spouse is really intimate and real, I sometimes feel disgust and really uncomfortable. How can I work through this? Why would I have that reaction? That's a good question. So ways of increasing intimacy, your technique of reading together is actually a superb way of increasing intimacy. And because it actually doesn't force you, but it encourages the two of you to talk together, and it introduces new topics where you can share how you both feel about it. It introduces discussion. It creates a common knowledge base between the two of you. It allows you to express differing opinions. There's a third party, and the two of you can begin practicing not even having the same concept and maybe still holding on to yourself or same belief, holding, kind of maintaining your own sense of peace and our centeredness even as you disagree on what that third party has said. And actually don't want to avoid those points of disagreement. Just remember, intimacy always creates short-term instability. But actually discussing and allowing your thoughts and your opinions and that conflict to flow is a huge way of increasing intimacy. Ways to increase spiritual intimacy, often even praying together and doing going to church together, those types of shared experience where it's an us sort of activity and we're sharing with other people, other couples, that will also increase intimacy. You talked about why when he's being really intimate and I sometimes feel disgust and really uncomfortable. Why do you have that reaction? There's actually, for people who aren't very comfortable with knowing someone and really being known, there's a concept called the intimacy tolerance factor, where you kind of reach your level of intimacy that you're comfortable with. And if you're comfortable with dealing with people on a 2 or 3 and you suddenly are with somebody who's talking at a 7 or an 8 or a 9, then you will automatically move into a great deal of discomfort and at times disgust, almost, because it's so unnerving what they're doing. And working through it, you actually have to start kind of fighting, I guess, a lie that you probably believe around the value or the lack thereof of this sort of intimacy. So if you, when you're talking to someone and they're, you know, sharing at a level that you're very uncomfortable with, look at them and keep telling yourself, you know, intimacy is actually something I long for, and I just need to learn how to relax while I listen, and I'm not going to judge it as good or bad. I just want to listen and try to know and learn something about, you know, them, and I want to begin to even develop this sort of ability. So hanging on to yourself and doing that, I think, will be very helpful when you're dealing with that intimacy. Next question. I'm anxious when I'm going to make love with my spouse. I want to be in the moment and just focus on him and let go. But I've never done this with anyone, with anything in my life, ever. When I'm alone, I feel like someone is watching me and I have to perform. So what you're describing is called spectatoring. And spectatoring happens with a lot of, if you've got somebody who's been fairly performance-oriented and the relationship is what I call requirement-based versus love-based, then it's always about having to please another person, that my value is based on my ability to perform, make you happy, and so ultimately I'm kind of living and performing for you, which, by the way, is amazingly codependent. What you want to be able to do is, you know, obviously make it event-based or kind of accepting the experience-based, not performance-based. And so in the moment, rather than spectatoring and performing, what you want to focus on is, how do I enjoy my mate right now? Not how do I please my mate, but shift the focus to, how much enjoyment can I find, you know, in my mate's hand, or how much enjoyment can I find touching his chest, or how much enjoyment. So it really becomes a different focus where you're working and focusing on enjoying them rather than trying to please them. And if you take that sort of, like with food, sometimes it's more of a savoring type of approach rather than, how can I chew the food? It's more like, how do I savor the food? Savor that flavor and become keenly aware of other aspects, almost open up my senses and experience more, all in the attempt to enjoy or to savor. And if you'll make that the goal, you'll find that you get out of a lot of the spectatoring. Another way to stay in the moment, one of the techniques we talked about before, is just have eyes open sex and try to make eye contact the whole time. Chris, for you, that could become a performance. But if you just consider that a person's eyes are the window to their soul, and if you can stay focused on that, it can make a huge difference. Crisis junkie. And hang on just a second, guys. Andrew, can you be here one for just a moment, too?
Mm-hmm.
I just want to give you pass a couple of things on to you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. Let's see. Crisis junkie. Is there hope for, I like this one, a recovering crisis junkie? How do I live a normal, happy life? I'm dealing my need for crisis with my husband's affair. It's interesting because, you know, for somebody who really operates a lot in a crisis, you're right. It's almost, there's such an intensity created do an affair. Some people who are very performance-oriented and do well in a crisis very much embrace kind of that whole challenge, and then as things begin to calm down, it can begin to feel a bit boring. This happens all the time for individuals in recovery. I found that one of my best friends who was a crack addict did when he first went into recovery, I mean, his life had been so crazy insane with the crack and the nuts. I mean, just plain nuts, the things he did and how close he flirted with death. And ultimately, when he went into recovery after he got clean and sober, he was bored to tears. And he didn't own anything anymore because while he was using it, it actually hawked everything he owned. So what he did in response was he went each night to HEB and stood in front of a grocery store here in Texas. And he stood in front of a magazine rack and he read every magazine. He did that for about 2 months until his wife decided to come back with him. And, you know, God bless the store manager, but by having something to do each night, it really facilitated his ability, I think, to begin to heal, and he desperately needed that. And he had to stay focused on something because that crisis really wasn't there, and he didn't want to create any more crisis to keep him being bored, so he just read magazines. I'm feeling my need for crisis with my husband's affair. I fear when we go back to normal and heal that I'll be looking outside for some kind of crisis or high. How do I stop this? Well, you know, actually, I find that life doesn't have to be boring. What is it? Somebody says, you know, only boring people get bored. That if you learn how to live life well, I think that it's anything but boring. I think you just need to be able to get beyond yourself. I mean, one of the pursuits that I really began was just how in the world do I begin to participate at a spiritual level in life? And that pursuit, participating, I think, with God and everything I was doing, actually made life not only not boring, but it was, you know, far more excitement than I could really handle. It was the issue of not trying to control. And I think that when we get into control, we're very likely to get bored because, I mean, I'm kind of limited by my own ability. But when I begin to live life out of control, trusting in something beyond myself to direct me, for instance, and actually having to listen and walk in weakness rather than strength, but again, always giving up control in order to find control. As I do that, that is not a boring process. So I think it's finding something to live for that actually is very energizing and exciting and challenging. And I think that works really well. So this next question is about family history. How important is understanding and digging into your family history to recovery? Why is this important? When I dig, all that happens is I get angry at my dad. So I think in the initial stages of recovery, understanding family history is probably not terribly important. At some point, it may be something you want to begin to look into and try to understand, and there may be some benefit. I know in my own personal recovery, one of the core problems I had was let me back up on family history. There is some medical family history that I think is really important. For instance, if you've got a long line of ancestors who have dealt with severe depression, or like in my family, some of them were kind of very impulsive and crazy and wild with serious addictions or whatever, then I think understanding those medical conditions are really important because it can be an indication of, genetically, maybe bipolar disorder, some genetic presuppositions to addictions or obsessive compulsive or depression. But so mental health history to me and medical history is very important, but that's because of beginning to understand genetics and what might we be dealing with that could be passing on from one generation to the next. The rest of the family history, I think, is probably after you kind of deal with some of your initial surrender and you're beginning to kind of dig a little bit to some of the root causes, maybe they're important. The only problem that I have with really focusing too quickly on family history is that it leads us to believe that we can maybe resolve this through its cause and effect, and then it takes a cause and effect look at it, and so then if I'm angry at my dad, then maybe I begin to blame my dad and not take personal responsibility, which then ends up being a liability and not a help. I will say, to me, when someone says that as they look at the family history, all they do is get mad at their dad, what that probably reveals is some unresolved resentments. And so then I think you've got to begin to do your own personal inventory about resentments and how in the world do I begin to forgive people for the wound that they've created to me, in the same way maybe I'm forgiven by others for the wounds I created in them. So I try to get out of a judgmental attitude, but family history, again, is something to me that's a little farther down the line, because it's largely about healing your heart and letting go of resentments and learning to see life in new ways and understanding things and getting me out of my own judgmental, resentful sort of attitude and getting me off the throne and beginning to ultimately care for other people. I learned that when I could begin to forgive and care in my family, I could pretty much do it across the board. And so they were the ultimate challenge going through all of that. So here's one about painful intercourse. I've got a long history of pain during sexual intercourse and also chronic yeast infections. The doctors have no explanation. Could this be due to OCD, lack of intimacy, need to always perform? I have had so many yeast infections that I literally want to lose my mind at the thought of getting another one. They are ruining my sex life. When you say the doctors have no explanations, one of the things that I think frequently can cause yeast infections is a problem with pH balance. Maybe you've checked with an endocrinologist, but I would certainly check with an endocrinologist and see if maybe there's something there. Another thing that I've run into with couples where there are kind of chronic yeast infections has been a lot of times they'll experiment with anal sex, and oftentimes it's not even a yeast infection they're actually kind of getting, but since the anus is not sterile, if people move back and forth between the anus and the vaginal area, oftentimes infections will occur. And other than that, an endocrinologist would be one of the first places I would check. And then the other thing is there's some diets, I'm going to say this wrong, but like I have had in the past chronic candida, chronic yeast infections like athlete's foot and fungus like that. And so eliminating sugars or some diet things frequently, if you look that up, that I think may also help. So those would be things to consider. If you know anybody that works with nutrition, they could probably give you some really good suggestions of ways of maybe altering your diet that might be really helpful. I was shocked at how much changing diet helped with yeast infections, like with my athlete's foot and stuff. So I would have never dreamed that would have had anything to do with it, and it had a lot to do with it, eliminating sugars and things like that. So here's a question from an unfaithful spouse. My mate wants to know if his parents and his mentor, or if he should tell his parents and his mentor about his sexual addiction and affairs. Is he supposed to be as careful as the hurt spouse in who to be honest about what happened? What stages should he confide? After we both are stable and healed, what's the purpose? He wants to be genuine and known. He's unsure why he wants to tell his parents. They're a big reason he ended up developing the sexual addiction. So, again, I think this is probably a little bit of work for individual therapy. I think that frequently talking to parents and being honest and authentic, especially if you've got a family where it's always been about image management, I think it's really important to begin to respond differently or find a new course of action to take with one's family. In my family, you know, I came up with that term of I'm a phobad, you know, I've got this fear of being a disappointment. Probably one of the primary people in life that I did not want to disappoint was my dad. So I think for my own healing, I needed to go a little bit at kind of part of the source of my behavior. And it was very good for me to kind of reclaim my own life by having to share or by sharing with my dad and having him know what was going on and telling him kind of how I was beginning to take personal responsibility for my own life. And it really was kind of a rite of passage. So sometimes I think clinically there's a really good reason to do it. In terms of his mentor, again, I don't know anything about his mentor, but part of me would say, you know, that may be a really good person to share about it. And as I would say, the sharing of information of what's happened and where you're coming from, the main criteria that I always look at is, does it serve a purpose in your recovery? And if it does indeed serve a purpose, then I think there's nothing wrong with doing that. You just need to, if it serves a purpose, then share. If it doesn't serve a purpose, then, you know, I think the two of you need to kind of decide why would we do that. And I know Stephanie and I actually kind of did it on a case-by-case basis. I mean, when I was going to talk to my dad, we both had already discussed that and decided that was probably a really good idea and turned out to be a great idea. Here's one on support groups. What support group do you think would be best for a hurt spouse beyond Harboring Hope? Al-Anon, AA, CODA. I have addictive tendencies and also severe codependency. You know, I think that if, you know, being a hurt spouse, both Al-Anon and CODA, in addition to Harboring Hope, have a lot of benefit and value. Now, the difference is Harboring Hope is a short-term, it's a 12-week more educational course and sets up a support system, hopefully afterwards, where the group will continue to communicate. But when you get to Al-Anon and CODA, you also have a situation where I think you can get a mentor, and again, it's going to stress the whole piece of gaining control by losing control and giving up control. And I think that whole technique of letting go is absolutely huge when it comes to recovery. I mean, I can be all powerful as long as I'm all lowly, so to speak. And it's really not about gaining control, it's about losing control. And so anytime you can be at a place where people are paradoxically trying to help you give up control and gain a different perspective or help you find a third option, a new way of looking at it, a new way of walking through it, then I think you'll find that to be incredibly helpful. And Al-Anon and CODA would be the ones that I would begin with, unless you've had a problem with alcohol in the past, in which case I would go to AA. What is blessing? My spouse is reading The Seven Desires of the Heart, and he says he did not receive a blessing from his parents. I don't understand what blessing means. Can you explain? Yeah, that is, again, let me see if I can find a good example of a blessing. I think it's very important to affirm children. And I think apart from that affirmation, It's almost like the good housekeeping seal of approval, so to speak. It lets them know that they mean something. So here's a blessing that one of my friends wrote to his son that I always liked. Zachary. And this was a written formal ceremony that he did with his son, and I've done the same with my children. In your life, I see the protector of the downtrodden, mercy shown to those who perhaps do not deserve mercy, the hand of an artist, the heart of a musician, and the feet of one who runs toward the truth and a burning desire for the inner workings of things. These character traits you possess are worth far more than riches or fame. To me, they're worth dying for. But the truth is, Zachary, were you to possess none of these things, even if you were cruel, vile, a young man who thought only of himself and used others to fill his own pleasure, I would still love you. I love you, Zachary, no matter what you have done or what you will ever do. When I look at you now, I think of the shepherd boy who would be king, a boy not chosen by those around him, but chosen by God. A boy with a heart on fire for God, but having only the clothes and the job of a shepherd. I see you sitting in a mountain meadow with your sheep and somehow transformed into a king through God's grace. Normal, maybe even mediocre to some, but to the Lord, you are a king and a priest. As I've prayed for you so many times before, I pray for you to dream dreams and to see visions of God's will and a will for your life and your part in the world. I call you to be a diligent reader of God's word and a diligent prayer warrior. And these things I pray for, your wife and your children's husbands and wives and children to the fifth generations. But tonight, I also pray that you would be as a shepherd in Jeremiah 23:4 that will feed the sheep of God that God sets under his care, that your sheep would fear no more, nor be dismayed, nor found lacking. And for the wounds that discard your heart, I pray you will come to a mature understanding of Isaiah 53:4. Surely he has borne our transgression, he has borne our griefs, and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him smitten, stricken by God, and afflicted, that he was wounded for our transgressions and he was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. My commitment to you, Zachary, is to follow God's word in Proverbs 27:3, to be diligent to know the state of you, a part of my flock, to attend to you, because I know the richness of your youth is not forever. And that you, my crown, will not endure to all generations. I will provide a warm and safe place for you to grow. I will pray that God's will is made plain to you and that you will have the courage to obey it. From his father, October 1993. It was interesting, after my friend went through the ceremony and read this to Zachary. And you can imagine, I mean, it was a very powerful thing to tell a young man what he was, you know, this father's blessing to him, just telling him who he saw him to be and almost sending him out 2 months later. Zachary actually was diagnosed with a glioblastoma multiforme grade 4, which is a type of brain cancer, and he died 50 weeks later. And I always thought, you know, what a tragedy it would have been if his father had never given him that blessing before he had the cancer. I'm very grateful that that blessing wasn't given in response to his illness. And just as Zachary, from that day on, he saw himself as special and as having meaning and a purpose in life. So when your husband says he didn't receive a blessing from his parents, it's almost like they never formally almost initiated him or gave him their support, their confidence, almost speaking confidence in his abilities and sharing with him what they see in him and what they think he's about and their dreams and their hopes for him. And that's an important thing for children to receive from their parents. There's a book by Gary Smalley and John Trent, I believe, called The Blessing. And if any of you listening to this ever want to do this for your children, highly recommend you read this book. I think you would find it to be amazing and very helpful. Reading material. Could you suggest some reading material for me? I'd like to have some devotional materials on being more Christ-centered, some authors you feel are motivational reading would be helpful too on living a Christ-centered life. So some of the books that I really enjoy some devotional books. I would look at, I like My Utmost for a Science by Oswald Chambers. It's been one of my favorites for years. I like Max Lucado and some of his books. If you'll just look, there's a bunch of his books. Just read through them. They're very inspirational, good devotional books, and I think would really help you. His writing style is very cool and will help you kind of be centered in your thinking. So much of recovery to me is about almost a recalibration of the heart and the mind, where we begin to move beyond ourselves and consider and turn an adoring gaze to something beyond ourselves. And that discipline is so incredibly important for us to mature as human beings. All too often, you know, that adoring gaze ends up being just like Narcissus, focused on our own image or our own reflection in the mirror, rather than being able to turn it outward and see other things. One of the, I think, neat benefits of people involved in formal church is, again, there's a corporate kind of turning that gaze away from self toward God, and I think that's a very important aspect. In terms of living a Christ-centered life, there's some really good Bible studies that I think you might enjoy. Something by Beth Moore would probably be good. And if you kind of read through, if you looked up Beth Moore and some of her books, she does a really nice job in some of her studies. And you might find one that kind of resonates as you read the descriptions on those things. There is some authors. There's a website. Let me see if I can find it here. It's, and I'll try to read this to you here. I got to get to it, guys. I'm sorry. I'm trying to kill time while I'm trying to find this thing. Always takes me just a minute to get to where I want to go here. Getting a little closer. So, there we go. There's another website you can go to. It's www.jesus.org.uk/e-books. So www.jesus.org.uk/e-books. The reason I love this little website, if you're into reading and you're a reader, it has got some of the old classics that I just love. And all literature that's over 100 years old is now public domain. So you don't have to buy these books. They're all free. In here, you might want to read, anything by Andrew Murray. I think you would find would be a good starting place. I think he does a really good job of kind of explaining that last piece you were just questioning on how you live that kind of
Christ-centered life. So, but you find all kinds of things in there that would be very useful. Okay, next. When my marriage becomes safe again is also when it's fragile the most, because many things are taken for granted again, which means we get exposed. But we cannot live in a constant state of fear. What can I or we do to keep guards high even when marriage is safe again? Right. That's a really good question. And I think that, you know, Peggy Bond's book on the monogamy myth, first off, you assume that the marriage is at risk. I just think in recovery, as long as I'm assuming weakness rather than trying to be strong and assuming, you know, literally looking at the fact that there are high-risk situations and kind of, I mean, so much of this is about almost education, learning what true love is versus learning what a craving is. You know, it's funny, guys. We will, just like with food, I can have these cravings. Like the other day I had craving for one of those ice cream drumsticks. You know, and the difference between a craving and true hunger is satisfied by most anything. A craving is very specific, and only one thing will do, and it's and I know that a craving is not health-based. A craving is based on a desire, almost a physiological arousal, a desire toward something. And so one thing I think that's important is for you and your mate to begin to identify what's real and what's counterfeit and kind of talk about that and then learn techniques such as kind of heartfulness. I mean, how do you kind of stay love-based and rather than becoming heartless and kind of self-centered? And there are some really good awareness techniques that exercises that you can do that I think really help facilitate dealing with cravings or desires, those rogue desires that come and help keep the relationship safe. And much of it, again, is about letting go of control in order to gain control. And it's about relaxation. It's about learning to see it differently. And so dedicating yourselves to understanding those things, I think, will go a long way to helping you. I'm sorry, I'm playing with my computer here because I got logged out. Excuse me, guys. I just want to make sure my questions have gotten answered. That's going to be something that's going to be helpful in the long run. Now, I'm almost back in again. Waited too long to hit the refresh button. Should have a little timer here that beeps so I remember to hit the refresh button before I get kicked out. And now the internet's going slow, so that's not helping us either. There we go. We're almost back. We're back in. Okay, it's going really slow over here in Texas. Some state is pulling up too much of the bandwidth. It's not fair. Okay, next, Felix. Rick, what is this? It seems to me that most women give feelings a great deal of weight when it comes to having sex with some man. They review their feelings and remember what they were like even after. Isn't it different for most men? How would you describe feelings for men versus feelings for women? Wow. Let's see. I'm thinking, I think that oftentimes desire, and I think for men, I don't know that it's all that different, even though there may be different feelings. I think that there are certain emotions that create that craving or that ultimately create desire. And the feelings to maybe do something or to act on something. The feelings that drive women, I think, probably are more relationally based. And so And the feelings for men, I think, maybe more physiologically kind of based, where a man might, for instance, the feeling of horny or the feeling of, you know, arousal, that limbic kind of feeling, I think may be more prevalent for men oftentimes. For women, I think it's more relationally based, and it's driven by, I think, what would be considered more kind of the connection verbs. But regardless, so I do think both men and women are motivated by feelings. I just think that probably they have different feelings. And so the feelings for women, I think, would be more feelings of connection, more feelings of security, more feelings of maybe more feelings of adoration. So I think sometimes those feelings, maybe they feel that the other person really, you know, likes them. Or sometimes I think it's because they feel strength and they're really attracted to that strength. Now, guys, I think, are going to be, rather than those sorts of characteristics or those sorts of emotions, I think it may come from emotions of sometimes almost being naughty or being bad, or sometimes, you know, they just think the other person's really hot and they find them incredibly attractive. You know, it's amazing. A lot of times I think it's not so much about who the person is as how the person's built. I mean, that's kind of a stereotypical look at it, but since men are visual, frequently that initial kind of drive is a feeling. They just see somebody and it pops the limbic system and they just find that particular look to be very, very arousing. That may, to some extent, be where it's at for the woman, but frequently the woman has more of a relationship connection. So to me, that's maybe how the two of those things differ a little bit. So hopefully I didn't embarrass myself with that question and end up with a lot of comments. So that's the last of the comments for the day, or the questions for the day. A great list of questions. Everybody, thank you. And I look forward to talking to you guys next week. So to healing, everyone. We'll catch you later. I'm trying to find how to turn this thing off now. It's been a long day here. There we go. That's the web page now. So everybody have a good week. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.